KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Democratic Congressman Jason Crow of Colorado questioned the intelligence officials who discussed a military operation in a group chat. How seriously does he think the administration is taking national security? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Vietnam's economy is booming after tariffs in Trump's first term shifted manufacturing out of China. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Now it has one of the biggest trade surpluses with the U.S., which is putting a target on its back for a new round of tariffs. Also, we speak with a lawyer for one of the Venezuelans deported to an El Salvador prison. She says a tattoo based on his favorite soccer team is being used to claim he's in a gang. It is Thursday, March 27th. On this day in 1912, First Lady Helen Taft helped plant cherry trees gifted by the mayor of Tokyo. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Department of Health and Human Services says it's going to lay off 10,000 full-time staffers, and an additional 10,000 will leave because of buyouts and retirements. Officials say this is part of President Trump's effort to downsize government. The officials say that the federal health programs, Medicare and Medicaid, will remain intact. The Trump administration has begun canceling billions of dollars of funding for projects related to the COVID-19 pandemic. NPR's Rob Stein has more on the rollback.
The Health and Human Services Department says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is canceling more than $11 billion in funding for a wide range of pandemic-related work, including COVID-19 testing, vaccination, and community health workers. NPR has also learned the National Institutes of Health has terminated a $577 million project to find new drugs to fight the virus that causes COVID, as well as other viruses that have the potential to cause the next pandemic. The administration says the decision was made because the pandemic is over and the terminations will save billions of dollars. Researchers say the COVID virus is still spreading and the moves leave the country more vulnerable to future pandemics. Rob Stein, NPR News.
President Trump says he'll impose fresh 25% tariffs on all imports of foreign cars. He says this will begin April 2nd, the same day a raft of other U.S. tariffs will be imposed. French officials say the tariffs leave the European Union with no other choice but to retaliate. New Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney says the Trump tariffs are a direct attack on Canadian auto workers. In the U.S., the United Auto Workers Union says it supports these Trump tariffs. Israel's government has passed a law that overhauls the country's judiciary. The move has sparked mass street protests. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
Israelis have protested in the streets this week against a law that parliament has now passed. The law changes how Israeli judges are appointed to the bench. They used to be selected by a committee of non-elected professionals and lawmakers. Under the new law, politicians will control judicial appointments. Israel's right-wing government says judges have too much power. Its attempts to remake the courts sparked massive pro-democracy street protests 2 years ago. When the Israel-Hamas war broke out, the government said it would pause the judicial overhaul. Now the government has resumed its efforts. Civil society groups are petitioning Israel's Supreme Court to overturn the new law. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The opposition party in South Sudan says its leader, the country's vice president, has been arrested. The United Nations warns the arrest comes as South Sudan is back on the brink of civil war. This is NPR. Federal immigration agents have arrested another international student, this time near Boston. Records show agents took Rumeysa Ozturk out of Massachusetts and put her in detention in Louisiana. Ozturk is studying for her PhD at Tufts University. She's from Turkey and in the U.S. on a visa. Last year, she wrote an editorial criticizing Tufts University for not condemning Israel's bombing of Gaza. The Trump administration claims, without evidence, she is supporting Hamas terrorists. As the weather warms up for spring across much of the U.S., gardeners are turning to plants. NPR's Neda Ulubi reports some are using a new technique to start growing them.
Soil blocking is not brand new, but it is beginning to catch on.
We started growing onion seed in the soil blocks that are smaller than these ones.
That's Christopher Hallett. He works at Growing Hope Urban Farm in Ypsilanti, Michigan. He's teaching other gardeners how to use a low-cost metal tool that compresses dirt, compost, and other ingredients into small, self-contained blocks. This cuts out plastic seedling containers, like the type sold at big box stores. Hallett says seed blocking is also a way to avoid using peat pots, also not a sustainable resource. Neda Ulubi, NPR News.
A new West Virginia law will ban certain food additives in schools by August. The food additives will also be banned statewide within 3 years. Analysts say this means that nearly two-thirds of the foods that are currently on shelves in West Virginia will have to come down. On Wall Street, stock futures are higher. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll ask how President Trump's tariffs on car imports could affect car prices. But first, did officials in the Trump administration put national security at risk when they communicated war plans over Signal? Lawmakers on the Hill have been grilling top intelligence officials about that for 2 days now. That's after The Atlantic magazine revealed this week that members of the Trump administration inadvertently included the magazine's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, in a group chat discussing a bombing campaign in Yemen. Here is Congressman Jason Crow, a Democrat from Colorado, and the House Intelligence Committee hearing yesterday.
Director Gabbard, have the Houthis indicated an ability to shoot down American aircraft?
Yes.
They have in fact done so, haven't they?
Yes.
Including MQ-9 Reapers, haven't they?
That's correct.
And that was one of the systems used in the attack recently that's the subject of this discussion, is it not?
Correct.
I want to mention here that Congressman Crow also served as an Army Ranger in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's with us now to tell us more about his thoughts about this. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
So I want to draw on that experience as a person who served in the military in volatile environments overseas. What was the risk of communicating sensitive military information using Signal?
Well, the most important thing when you're conducting an operation is the element of surprise, right? The adversary cannot know you're coming because they, of course, can prepare for that. The risk goes up exponentially. And people can die. It's not hyperbole to say that if the adversary knows that you're coming, the risk of casualties goes up tremendously. So that's what we're talking about here. And with the Houthis, we're talking about a very sophisticated military force. This isn't a bunch of people rolling around in the back of pickup trucks with AK-47s. They have some of the most sophisticated weapon systems in the world, thanks to the Russians and others. And we have to be very careful when we're dealing with that.
So you've been calling for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to resign. Why him, and why not Mike Waltz, who says that he is the one who created the group chat? And what do you think that would accomplish?
Well, Secretary Hegseth is the one who has executive authority over our nation's largest agency, you know, the agency that's charged with protecting our country, right? And I said from day one that Pete Hegseth is not qualified for this job. He doesn't have any experience working at a high level in national security. He has no experience running large organizations. And you see what happens now when you have somebody without the experience and expertise to handle sensitive matters. What happens is they act in a careless and reckless way. He doesn't take it seriously. And the risk for our men and women in uniform is very high as a result of that.
So at the moment, Defense Secretary Hegseth doesn't seem inclined to resign, and the president doesn't seem inclined to ask him to or require him to. So what do you believe this administration should do now to show that it's taking this matter seriously?
Well, just because they won't enforce standards and they don't hold themselves to the same standards as they expect of everyone else doesn't mean that we should get rid of our standards. If this had happened to a private, to a sergeant, to a general, anybody who I served with and anybody below the chain of command from Pete Hegseth, those folks would have instantly been investigated, probably relieved of command or responsibility, and potentially even court-martialed. So what the Trump administration is saying is, you know what, the people at the top, they run by different rules. They're protected and the rules don't apply to them, which of course sends a message that, you know, culture is dysfunctional and sends a message down the chain of command that these things don't matter. So that's where things start deteriorating within organizations, and that's where people end up getting killed. So I'm not going to allow the lack of standards of the Trump administration to dictate what I do and don't do. I'm going to just call it like I see it, and I'm going to say that people should resign if they mess up at this level.
So to that end, Republicans attacked former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server for years, even though there's no evidence that it was ever compromised. But now it seems that Democrats, mainly Democrats, some Republicans, but mainly Democrats are gearing up, as you just said, to keep talking about this and to continue to attack these officials for their use of Signal. Is there a way to avoid this becoming just another political football and really reemphasize security best practices?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we're not going to wrestle with the pig and get muddy here. What we're going to do is actually just talk about the facts. We're not going to play the political theater that the Trump administration and the people closest to Trump always play. We're just going to explain in very common terms what's happening here and why this is important, why the culture of recklessness and carelessness at the very top within the Trump administration is putting the lives of our men and women at stake, and why that has to change, and why that is important to American people, and why they should, frankly, be extremely upset about it.
That is Congressman Jason Crow. He is a Democrat from Colorado, and he sits on the House Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. And as we said, he's a combat veteran. Congressman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Morning Edition reached out to Republican lawmakers, representatives for the White House, and every Trump administration official who was in the Signal chat group. All either declined or did not respond to our requests for interviews. And I also want to note that NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation.
President Trump announced that he's imposing a 25% tariff on all car imports.
He says the money collected will boost government revenues and encourage automakers to build cars and parts in the U.S. rather than import them.
I think our automobile business will flourish like it's never flourished before.
But auto service providers like Cox Automotive estimate that that could add thousands of dollars to car prices if the tariffs go through. And stocks of automakers declined in the hours before the announcement, underscoring the uncertainty Trump's trade policy is having on markets.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is here to tell us all about this. So, Franco, let's start off with the goals of these tariffs and the concerns they're raising.
Yeah, Trump says these tariffs will go into effect next week. Now, they apply to both autos and auto parts. Trump is kind of painting this as a way to jumpstart the auto industry and raise tens of billions of dollars in revenue. He says auto companies, even foreign ones, will build more operations in the U.S. or expand existing ones. And he's criticized those who took operations in the past out of the U.S.
So we'll effectively be charging a 25% tariff? But if you build your car in the United States, there is no tariff. And what that means is a lot of foreign car companies, a lot of companies are going to be in great shape because they've already built their plant. but their plants are underutilized, so they'll be able to expand them inexpensively and quickly.
But as Michelle noted, the move is also raising a lot of concerns.
Ooh, let's talk about those concerns. Who are the winners and the losers here?
Well, one of the big winners are the auto unions. The United Auto Workers Union, for example, is praising this decision, saying it's time to, quote, end the free trade disaster. But the big three automakers, Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, are very concerned. You know, they have production spread out across the world, including Canada and Mexico. And the cars and the parts are going to be tariffed. You know, they've raised big concerns in the past when these threats were posed. And a group that represents foreign automakers, like BMW, Honda, has also raised concerns that it's all just going to make it more expensive to produce cars and lead to higher prices.
So how do these fit into Trump's larger trade policy?
Yeah, Trump's already imposed a bunch of other tariffs on steel and aluminum, as well as other goods from China, Canada, and Mexico. And these new tariffs come just a week ahead of his promised announcement of reciprocal tariffs on imports, which he says are, you know, for the countries that impose tariffs on the U.S. But he did yesterday back off a bit on how tough those reciprocal tariffs will be. Yesterday, he said people may be surprised that they're going to be more lenient than they once feared. He also did say, though, to expect tariffs on lumber and pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, you know, it does seem like President Trump loves tariffs or even the threat of tariffs. Economists don't seem to share that view. How do you square those two things?
Yeah, he really does love tariffs. He says that all the time. I mean, he argues that they're an important tool to be used for leverage on things like national security and other U.S. interests. But you're absolutely right. Most economists say tariffs raise prices for consumers, and that could hurt the economy. Trump often uses them as a negotiating tool, and that has really made economists even more worried. And that's because of the uncertainty that they cause, and you see that in the markets. Now, in some cases, he says these tariffs will go away if countries do things that he wants, like help him with immigration. But this time, he says he's serious and that these car tariffs are here to stay.
All right, we'll see. That's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
This year's Grammy winner for Best New Artist, Chappell Roan, is a certified pop music star. But the Midwest princess, as she is known, decided to head south on a new country-infused single. The question is, will country radio embrace it? Here's Hazel Sills from NPR Music.
Chappell Roan originally premiered her song, The Giver, on Saturday Night Live last November, and she'd been teasing its release for weeks. Now that it's finally out, the song debuted at number 5 on Billboard's main pop chart. Of course, she's no stranger to that chart. The big question is, what happened on the country charts? Despite this being a loud and proud, fiddle-driven track, it doesn't quite fit the blueprint of a typical mainstream country hit, given Roan's total absence from the genre before now, and the song's cheeky, queer messaging. Nonetheless, The Giver did debut at number 1 on the Hot Country Songs chart.
You ain't gotta tell me, it's just in my nature. So take it like a taker, so baby, I'm a giver.
Now, this needs some explaining. In 2012, Billboard changed how the charts data is measured. It previously only counted radio play on country format stations. That was changed to include stations across genres. The move was controversial because it meant that pop artists who make crossover country songs, like Beyoncé and Post Malone, would be favored. Billboard also has a separate country airplay chart, and the discrepancies have been clearer ever since. For example, Taylor Swift's sort of pop, sort of country hit, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together, spent 10 weeks at number 1 on the Hot Country Songs chart, despite only peaking at 13 on the country airplay chart back in 2012. Chappell Roan may be number 1 this week on Hot Country Songs, but she's not even in the top 50 of country airplay. Roan may be a giver, but it remains to be seen if country radio will be a taker. Hazel Sills, NPR Music.
She gets a job done.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Syria may be on the verge of a new era of unity, or it may descend into anarchy, and the outcome will affect the Middle East and the U.S. Syria's transitional president founded the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda, but he's now preaching inclusivity. We'll talk with Robert Wirth of The Atlantic about his reporting. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach. Starts Friday in theaters. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses, at easycater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're reporting from China this week and are in Shanghai today. A team of us has been traveling around this enormous coastal region, dozens of cities where people manufacture everything from keychains and stuffies to cars to products run by artificial intelligence. And as part of our reporting, we are following the money, or to be exact, following the trade, because while China remains the world's factory, some of the business is moving south. This is a big deal. NPR's John Ruich is with me here and is just back from Vietnam. Hey there, John.
Hey, Steve.
So what's going on down there?
Well, a lot of the business is moving south. Actually, there's this manufacturing boom that's happening down there. You know, for years, people have talked about having to have a China plus one strategy, which means manufacture in China, but also diversify into other countries like Vietnam, like other places in Southeast Asia, so that you're not stuck with a supply chain that's beholden to just one country. And Vietnam is absolutely taking off now.
Well, let's listen to what you found.
2 hours by car from the Vietnamese capital Hanoi, a fresh crop of factories and construction cranes rises out of green fields.
3.5 years ago, this was a rice paddy. Now you see a four-lane road, and all the factories in this main road that you see were simply non-existent.
Bruno Jaspert runs the company that's developing this industrial zone near the coast in Guangning province. The firm, called Deep Sea, that's the letter C, has been in business in Vietnam since 1997. In its first 21 years of existence, until about 2018, Jaspert says, it attracted about $1 billion in foreign direct investment.
From then till now, we managed to collect another seven.
That's $7 billion over just the past 7 or 8 years.
That gives you an idea of how fast it goes. And I need to point out, we had 2 years of COVID in that, and the country was locked up.
The world's manufacturers have been scrambling to diversify away from China, where U.S. tariffs have raised costs and geopolitics have raised concerns for businesses. Deep Sea has gone from running one industrial zone in northern Vietnam to five. The factories in them make everything from shower heads to Apple Watches. And a lot of it gets shipped to the world's biggest economy, the United States, now Vietnam's top export market.
So the economic relationship has taken off. It's surging.
Ted Osius is a former U.S. ambassador to Vietnam. He now leads the U.S. ASEAN Business Council. Last week, he was in Hanoi with the council's biggest trade and investment delegation ever to visit Vietnam. It comes 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War and 30 years after the establishment of formal bilateral ties.
There's no country in Southeast Asia that inspires kind of more excitement about opportunity than Vietnam.
Excitement and some nervousness these days. Vietnam's trade surplus with the U.S. has ballooned, surpassing $123 billion last year, according to official statistics. It's now number three after China and Mexico on the list of countries with which the U.S. has its biggest deficits. Some fear that puts Vietnam in the Trump administration's crosshairs.
So I think it's reasonable to predict that there will be tariffs on Vietnam. And what I'm recommending to the Vietnamese is to be proactive in dealing with the situation.
Vietnam's Minister of Industry and Trade made a trip to Washington earlier this month, and U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer told him Vietnam needs to improve the trade balance and open up more. Message received, apparently. The Vietnamese authorities announced cuts to tariffs on several U.S. imports this week. They've flagged possible purchases of U.S. farm goods, gas, and defense equipment. Vietnamese airlines plan to buy hundreds of Boeing airplanes. The government says it's preparing to license Elon Musk's Starlink satellite internet network. And last fall, a Vietnamese property company struck a deal to develop a $1.5 billion golf resort in Vietnam with the Trump Organization. Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Bùi Thanh Xuân addressed the U.S.-ASEAN Business Council.
On our part, Vietnam remains committed to creating favorable conditions for business, for foreign business and investors, including those from the U.S.
The welcome mat does seem to be out. In December, Jensen Huang, CEO of AI chipmaker NVIDIA, came to Hanoi. He was treated like a rock star. Prime Minister Phan Minh Chinh personally took him out for beers in the city's old quarter. Today, several large photos of Huang and the PM hang prominently on the walls of the bar. And Huang's visit to Vietnam is a point of pride, says waiter Nguyen Van Sack. Back at the industrial zone, CEO Bruno Jaspert says this new era of geopolitical uncertainty and rapid change could actually be a good opportunity here.
My own personal view is for Vietnam, it should be positive.
Positive, he says, if they play their cards right.
NPR's John Ruich is just back from Vietnam. John loved hearing the sounds of Vietnam there. He's with me in Shanghai. And John, we were talking there about American firms, European firms moving stuff to Vietnam, but an economist was telling me recently that even Chinese companies are investing in Vietnam. What's going on?
Yeah, Chinese companies, Japanese companies, Korean companies, anybody exporting to the U.S., exporting out of Asia is looking for opportunities in places like Vietnam.
We get an idea from your story that one motivation might be to avoid U.S. tariffs if they can, but are there other reasons that Vietnam is attractive?
Yeah, Vietnam's growth rate is around 7% a year, so it's faster than China. Vietnam sort of has this great relationship with the United States now, 30 years after establishing relations. It's a way to hedge geopolitical risk that it might otherwise have in China. The population is also quite young in Vietnam.
And the Vietnamese themselves seem to be eager to make deals. I did take note of the brand of satellite company they were looking at, Starlink, and also the brand of golf course.
Right. They talk about the Vietnamese having a bamboo foreign policy, which means they blow with the wind. They'll go whichever direction they need to go. They have friends. They don't have a lot of allies, but they seem to get it done.
NPR's John Ruich, thanks for your insights.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
The war between Russia and Ukraine is now largely being fought with drones. And while Ukraine is at the cutting edge of drone innovation, Russia isn't far behind.
Once you've got a technology, other side tries to counter. It's a constant war of innovations and war of technologies.
I'm Elsa Chang. Ukraine and Russia's fight for the skies. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is announcing the elimination of 20,000 full-time jobs. 10,000 people are being laid off. Others are voluntary departures. Today's action leaving a smaller workforce to oversee the FDA, the CDC, NIH, and other divisions. The administration's DOJ is shrinking or gutting agencies across the federal government. The federal judge who has clashed with President Trump in a migrant deportation case is now overseeing the case involving a high-level group chat about military attack plans on the unsecured Signal messaging app. This is now the fourth Trump-related case before U.S. District Judge James Boasberg. On Truth Social, Trump writes, it's disgraceful Boasberg was handed a fourth Trump case, which he says is statistically impossible. Meanwhile, congressional Democrats, including Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, says people need to be held accountable for the Signal chat security failure.
When I saw the details of what was shared over Signal by the Secretary of Defense, I was shocked. And there should be consequences for this kind of recklessness.
The White House maintains no classified information was disclosed, but it is investigating how a journalist was mistakenly included in the Signal thread. Note, NPR CEO Catherine Marr is the board chair of the foundation that supports the app. From Washington, this is NPR News. In the administration's crackdown on illegal immigration, Attorney General Pam Bondi says authorities have arrested a notorious gang leader unlawfully residing in Virginia.
Early this morning, one of the top leaders of MS-13 was apprehended. He was the leader for the East Coast, one of the top three in the entire country.
It's unclear if authorities plan to deport the alleged gang leader to El Salvador, which the U.S. says it is paying to imprison criminal deportees. Syrian and Lebanese state media say Israeli attacks have hit a port and military installations on Syria's Mediterranean coast, as well as several areas of southern Lebanon. Lebanon's health ministry says at least four people have been killed there. NPR's Lauren Frayer has more from Damascus.
The Israeli military published aerial footage of an airstrike that exploded a car on a road in southern Lebanon. It says the target was a Hezbollah battalion commander responsible for attacks on Israeli troops and civilians. Lebanese state media say an Israeli drone also hit another car near an orphanage in the country's south, and that Israeli artillery hit yet another town there. Israel has continued to attack Lebanon despite a shaky ceasefire in place since November. Meanwhile, Syrian state media say the Mediterranean port in Latakia was struck by Israeli airstrikes, along with military installations nearby. Footage on social media shows a huge pre-dawn fire there. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, Damascus.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. By now you may have seen the images. Men dressed in matching prison whites, heads freshly shaved, frog marched into detention. Earlier this month, the United States deported them, alleged they are all part of an international criminal gang, and agreed to pay El Salvador $6 million to imprison them for a year. One of the men, he's
He has on his arm of a soccer ball with a crown on top. DHS says a crown tattoo is proof of gang membership. And the second thing is this hand gesture that he made in a couple of Facebook posts from over 10 years ago that, again, DHS says is proof of gang membership, but it's also a very common sign that's commonly known as the rock and roll hand signal, or it's sign language for I love you.
And how do you know his tattoo is just about soccer?
First of all, his own testimony to me, but we have contacted the tattoo artist who confirmed that he is the one who gave this tattoo, and he's confirmed what it represented, which is a basic replication or a tribute to the logo of his favorite soccer team, the Real Madrid from Spain. We have also submitted a record from Venezuela showing that he has no criminal record.
DHS spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin wrote on X that your client was in the country illegally and said the agency is confident he's part of a Venezuelan gang. Quote, DHS intelligence assessments go beyond a single tattoo and we are confident in our findings. What do you make of that statement?
It's not true. I have the document, a printout showing that he had a CBP1 appointment, and that's when he was detained. And I've seen the evidence, and all it is the tattoo and the hand gesture. Look, DHS wants the public to believe these people are criminals and gang members. So if they have proof of that, why wouldn't they release it to the public?
I want to ask the difference in treatment of your client. I mean, your client crosses the border in the right way, starts the asylum process, is detained, is held in a maximum security prison, and then this new administration comes in and he's deported. What changed about the case, and would this have been the fate either way?
No. I've been practicing immigration law for 28 years.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like this. It's uncharted territory. I expect he would have remained detained until he had his hearing and the judge made a decision. And if the decision was negative, then he would have been deported, but not to El Salvador, but to Venezuela. And if he had been granted asylum, eventually he would have been allowed to leave prison and start a life in the U.S. Nothing changed about the facts or even the procedure of his case. The only thing that changed is the president.
Is it normal for the Department of Homeland Security to focus on a tattoo on social media posts?
I wouldn't say it's unusual. They are definitely combing social media posts and any other information to vet people to make sure that they're not criminals. And don't get me wrong, I'm fine with that. If someone has a criminal record, they should be imprisoned. But my client doesn't have that. And the reason we have courts and judges in this country is so that a judge can look at the evidence and make a fair, independent determination of what the evidence says. And instead, DHS is making these snap judgments with life-threatening consequences for these people based on flimsy evidence that a judge has not been able to review and make a determination or an adjudication.
That's immigration attorney Lynette Tobin. We asked the Department of Homeland Security for additional comment, and so far it has not responded.
The CEOs of NPR and PBS defended their networks against allegations of bias yesterday on Capitol Hill. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik was at the House hearing. And a reminder, under NPR's protocol for covering itself, David and his editors operate without any involvement from corporate officials or news executives.
The hearing veered between accusatory questions from the Republican majority.
I've lost confidence in public radio. I don't think, Madam Chair, they should get a penny of federal funds.
And measured responses from public media executives.
There's nothing more American than PBS.
Perhaps that's to be expected from a session entitled Anti-American Airwaves, Holding the Heads of NPR and PBS Accountable. A couple of things soon became clear. NPR was more clearly in the line of rhetorical fire than PBS, perhaps because it is more news programming. And also because Republican lawmakers feasted on NPR chief executive Catherine Marr's social media posts before she joined NPR last year.
Let me inform you, and that so that your federal funding is also paid for by the other half of the country.
Here's the subcommittee's chairperson, Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene.
The 77 million Americans who voted for President Trump, someone you called a deranged, racist sociopath.
Marr's response involved the three R's. Regret some past news judgments, like on Hunter Biden's laptop, reiterate new initiatives to make sure standards are fair, and repeat. A senior editor's essay last year alleging liberal bias at NPR was followed by changes in the newsroom. Marr says NPR has sought to
beef up our editorial practices, bringing in more editors to make sure that we have more points of view reflected in every story.
Marr and PBS's Paula Kerger defended the use of taxpayer dollars to support public media. Through their local stations, NPR and PBS serve more than 99% of the country and are a vital part of local emergency and disaster planning around the nation. The question looming over the hearing was, would Republicans use it to push for deep cuts or elimination of federal funds for public media? But then again, it wasn't much of a question. Again, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene.
After listening to what we've heard today, we will be calling for the complete and total defund and dismantling of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
NPR gets about 3-4% of its revenues from federal sources, PBS about 16%. Kerger and Marr say the slashing of federal funds would hurt local stations far more, especially in rural areas, a point echoed by Democrats. Taxpayer support represents as much as 50% of some small stations' annual budgets. David Folkenflik, NPR News, Washington, D.C.
This is NPR News.
Thousands of Americans are victims of scams, some of which are highly sophisticated. How to recognize scams and avoid becoming a victim. Next time, here and now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today. Your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Here's how the University of Maryland is describing its next commencement speaker, environmental advocate, best-selling author, Peabody Award winner, but what are his politics? Amphibitarian. Yes, it's Kermit the Frog. It's a homecoming of sorts. Kermit's creator, the late Jim Henson, graduated from the University of Maryland College Park in 1960. An early version of Kermit appeared on Henson's first show, Salmon Friends, which he started as a freshman. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. The 2025 Major League Baseball season begins in earnest today. 14 games are scheduled to take place. Here with what he's expecting this season is reporter Steve Futterman. So, Steve, the last time we spoke, the Dodgers had just beaten the New York Yankees in the World Series. You were in New York then. Today you're in Los Angeles. And I know a lot of Dodger fans expect this season could end up pretty much the same way.
That's right. Now, many fans think it's unfair, but the Dodgers, with baseball's biggest payroll, more than $320 million, at least on paper, have an even stronger lineup than last year. They are led, of course, by the great Shohei Ohtani. And at some point this year, in addition to hitting, Ohtani will be back on the mound pitching with his surgically repaired elbow. We think that's likely to come in May.
Yeah, and the thing with Shohei Ohtani is that no one, not even Babe Ruth, has been able to do what he has done in his career so far.
Yeah, the guy's amazing. And just listen to his manager, Dave Roberts, talk about him.
I think Shohei just seems like a superhero. And in the biggest of games or the biggest of moments, he seems to always deliver.
Now, LA made several major offseason acquisitions, including another Japanese star, Roki Sasaki, a right-handed pitcher. So the Dodgers are again loaded. And with what at times seems to be an unlimited amount of money to get the players they want, some non-LA baseball fans are labeling the Dodgers. I know this may bother you, A, being a Dodger fan, but some are labeling the Dodgers the evil empire.
No, not at all. They outspend everyone. Even the Yankees say they can't compete with the Dodgers spending, if you can believe the Yankees, the old evil empire, saying that. Now, the acquisition of Sasaki was indeed a very, very big acquisition, but really the biggest offseason free agent signing involved a guy named Juan Soto.
Absolutely. Now, last year, Soto was one of the big stars for the Yankees. He is still in New York, but he's moved across town to join the New York Mets. Now, the Mets last year made it all the way to the National League Championship Series. They're hoping Soto is the missing piece to get back to the World Series. They signed him to a remarkable 15-year contract worth $765 million. Soto says the key reason he chose the Mets was their desire to win.
Definitely, that was one of the things that opened my eyes more. How hungry they are to win a championship and to want to make a dynasty.
All right, so speaking of the Yankees, they have lost two key players from last year's American League championship squad.
Yeah, that's right. Not just Soto, who's now, as we mentioned, with the Mets, but the Yankees pitching ace Gerrit Cole. He's out for the season after undergoing Tommy John surgery. New York did acquire free agent pitcher Max Fried. He played the last several years with the Atlanta Braves, but replacing both Soto and Cole will be difficult. Still, the Yankees are the pick of many to again top the American League. One team, some expect to challenge the Yankees. Watch out for the Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah, the Yankees also have Giancarlo Stanton, their slugger, out indefinitely with tendonitis in both elbows. A lot of injuries to start the season. Steve, tell us about the two teams in Major League Baseball that will technically play home games, just not in their home ballparks.
Yeah, that's right. The Tampa Bay Rays are not able to play at their regular home, Tropicana Field. It was damaged by Hurricane Milton in October, so they will play at the spring training home of the Yankees in Tampa. As for the team formerly known as the Oakland A's, they are headed to Las Vegas, but the new stadium being built there won't be ready until 2028, so they are playing this year in Sacramento at the home of the minor league Sacramento River Cats. And this year they won't have any city attached to their name. They will only be called the A's or the Athletics.
They're kind of named after me, the A's. That's reporter Steve Futterman in Los Angeles. The Dodgers have their home opener tonight against the Detroit Tigers. Steve, thanks.
Thank you, Ray.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It seems like they came out of nowhere. The singer-songwriters Lucy Dacus, Phoebe Bridgers, and Julian Baker formed a supergroup called Boy Genius. 2 years ago, they released an album that outperformed any of their dreams for it. They called it The Record. It soared to number 4 in the charts, and they won 3 Grammy Awards. So how do you follow that?
I don't think I can repeat any of that. It feels like a fluke experience, a happy fluke.
That's Lucy Dacus, and she's the first of the 3 to offer a solo album since Boy Genius went on hiatus. It's called Forever Is a Feeling.
If I stay busy, maybe I'll forget how I feel and go.
Lucy Dacus has been through a lot of change since Boy Genius. She said, you have to destroy things in order to create things. And I did destroy a really beautiful life.
I moved across the country. Like, I'm from Richmond, Virginia, and then lived in Philly, and now I'm living in LA, which feels so different. And I think when you move, you can't conflate your identity with the place you've always been. So I felt it was easier to, like, see who I am in an unfamiliar place. So yeah, just like a lot of changes, a lot of relationships changed, and the way I made this record was also very different. Mm-hmm. I feel like every time I make something, I have to relearn how to do it. Well, I was writing the songs, and I noticed that they were very, like, heartful, and, you know, they're love songs mostly, and I was just thinking about how most art through time has been motivated by love, so it's not like it's new material. So while I was recording, I was just thinking about antiquity, both like sonically and visually. That's why I like the oil painting for the album cover and having a harpist and strings players and just kind of hearkening back to some older sounds. I just thought that would make sense.
Okay, I want to talk about ankles. What inspired that song?
It's pretty cut and dry with the lyricism, just like, okay, so I want you, but I can't have you, so I just have to think about you and pretend to be satisfied with that alone. So it's kind of this like playful frustration and just like the tension of wanting somebody.
Agent of chaos, angel of death, one of 3 ancient fates, playing with your scissors again.
I also love Best Guess. It expresses just a beautiful sentiment.
I love your body. I love your mind. They will change. So will mine.
I love your body. I love your mind. They will change, so will mine. It almost brought me to tears just because after a very long relationship, that is something that you confront, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, people get sick, their bodies change, things happen. I just found myself asking, like, so how could, forgive me, I mean, I hope I'm not patronizing you, but I just wondered how somebody your age would have an insight like that. Where did that come from?
This feels like a huge compliment. I think I laugh because my dad asks me this all the time. He's like, it took me decades longer than you to realize that. Like, how did this happen? And it might be because I read a lot. You know, I haven't really thought about this, but in answering this question, I'm like, it might just be because I'm reading a lot of perspectives all the time. And also in books, there's actually duration and breadth that you can't fit into music most of the time.
And the other piece about it that I appreciated is that this is a song that so many people could embrace. You know what I mean? I can see this as a wedding song for lots of different people.
I really hope it will be. I thought after I wrote it, I was like, this would be sweet vows.
After all, it's a small world. You may not be an angel, but you are my girl. You are my Packer Day. You are my favorite place. You were my best friend before you were my.
Before we let you go, the Boy Genius Project made a lot of people very happy. I personally can attest that my daughter was obsessed with that album. I heard it very often. A lot of young women really appreciated that album. So I did want to ask if you think that you might get together for another album.
There are no plans. I think we have a lot of hanging out to do before we even talk about that. We decided at the beginning of Boy Genius we would put in 1 year just to protect like our friendship, because if you are constantly commodifying your relationship, it can start to become a product and not just the reality of your life. So that's what we've been doing since Boy Genius, is just hanging out and basically detoxing from being like viable. You know, Boy Genius lives in our hearts. That's how I feel.
That's Lucy Dacus. Her new album is called Forever is a Feeling. Lucy Dacus, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you too.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martin.